My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Paul McEvitt of Fujitsu.
Hi Ian, Paul McEvitt. So I look after our threat intelligence and threat analytics capability at Fujitsu.
We hear a lot about threat intelligence today, but to most people it's sort of a bit of a dark art. Can you give us a view as to what it is?
Or a feed, or a threat feed. So in terms of what we do day to day, how we look at threat intelligence, if you can imagine starting with the typical attacks that an organisation might face, some phishing attacks, web-borne attacks, things that are delivered via exploit kits, phishing attacks that evade traditional security platforms, and essentially start with that as the basis of analysing attacks and trends in attacks and use that as a basis for threat intelligence.
How easy is it to get that data together? Because if we look at the number of sources we have for gathering data around an enterprise, it's end-user devices, it's all the log files, it's other security devices. How are people coping with bringing that together to actually find those patterns rather than just drowning under that amount of data?
We have a person in the team whose job it is solely to look at different email security platforms and monitor phishing campaigns across multiple different platforms. That's across different vendors, so you can see which attacks, which phishing spam campaigns are a bit successful getting through different vendors. We've collected that much information in a database that we knew when attacks change from maybe we deliver a macro-enabled document to Excel via a link. We've worked with government agencies on being able to provide a vast amount of data of stuff that we've collected over a period of time.
Are you feeding that back to Sticks and Taxi so that there's a wider use of that data?
At the moment, no. We've got a K5 public cloud platform, so we're building a MISP instance. We're standing up our own MISP instance with a view of initially having threat intelligence sharing capability between different Fujitsu entities. Obviously, we're a huge organization. There's a lot of other security teams across Fujitsu and individuals that might feed into that. So with a view to working with, so obviously, CERT has got their own Sticks and Taxi sharing element, and that's what we'll be doing.
With so many security teams around Fujitsu, how hard is it internally to actually bring all that knowledge into one place?
It's getting easier. We are moving towards a global security organisation. I think in the past it's been disparate teams. We've had different SOCs. We're now working towards standing that up as a full Fujitsu global security offering.
Will that then become a public sale point to customers?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
In terms of the analytics, what are you using as database engines underneath? Are you running it all in memory, or are you at the moment still sifting through and deciding where you go?
We use a lot of open source tools. From pulling information from different sources of information together, we'll use open source sort of SIM platforms. We use ELK a lot in terms of being able to find spots and patterns. It ultimately depends what we're looking for. It could be that we're just looking for user agents, and it might be that we just pull off some proxy logs, and it's actually that's easier to do. Typically, though, our main SIEM platform is Log4Them.
If you look at the amount of data that comes into threat intelligence platforms, one of the challenges, manpower searching through it, people seeing it in time. How far away are you from considering machine learning or AI or some other solution in that space?
I probably look at this in two ways. There's machine learning and AI in terms of analytics and being able to make predictions based on an event or something that is happening, and then AI, machine learning and reasoning based on trying to improve a service or something that an analyst might do, making that process quicker, faster, getting a machine to do it. Can we automate some of that process? And then following on from that can also get machine learning and reasoning to do some of those things for you based on previous scenarios. There's two different ways looking at it. From machine learning technology, we're looking at a couple of vendors in that space. I think that gives a little bit of a different perspective in terms of what a security operations center needs to do. Obviously, from a signature-based scenario, you're looking for what's known bad. From a machine learning AI point of view, you're potentially just looking for something that's anomalous, and that gives a different perspective on what a security operations center analyst has to do, because they're potentially having to piece a jigsaw together and go and find, was the receptionist meant to be looking at that database at midnight, rather than, you know, a signature's fired and we know that it's a certain piece of malware that we've seen in the past.
That behavioural analytics of what is person X doing, what is service Y doing, what is application Z doing, gets quite complicated as you start to deal with multinational corporations with round-the-sun operations. How do you refine that down? Because a user might change location. Therefore, they initially look like they're accessing out of time zone, but actually they're really accessing their job in that time zone they're in.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it's putting that piece of the puzzle together. It might be logging on from the VPN at different times or different zones, or maybe they have been working on a long project that's required them to stay on for 12 hours rather than 8 hours. Maybe they've shared their admin account and actually somebody else has also used it, and therefore they look as though that admin account's been valid or active for 24 hours. That's why I say there's an element of you have to pick apart the bones of what an event looks like and what an incident looks like and follow that through. What we do in terms of customers, we have an interface into the customer, basically an information security manager. A lot of what we'll do is link in with them as the interface to the customer, their chain system, was this expected, we'll liaise with the customer, we can then paint a picture of whether it was an issue or not.
You talked there about, you know, people sharing admin accounts and other things. Everybody does it. I don't care what they say. And all of it breaches internal company security policy. But we have a big disconnect between what is seen as IT policy for controlling access rights and user logons and what is seen as deep security. Are you seeing customers beginning to finally bring those two together and make security teams part of IT instead of at the moment in most companies where they kind of sit on their own?
I'd say we still face that same challenge, absolutely. It's all about essentially a learning experience. It's awareness. You know, we always talk about end-user awareness and trying to make that applicable to somebody's home life, and therefore they might get it. Security isn't baked into everybody's job every single day, and sometimes it's what is the easiest thing to do is what they'll do first. That, the same goes for storing passwords. We found an SA password on a notepad, on a desktop, on a server recently. It's things like that that you're still fighting against and trying to establish is bad practice.
In terms of feeding information across, in terms of saying, hey, we've spotted this, this is what you guys need to be looking at. Because when I look at the moment, I see security team spots it and takes their action, but they don't have that knowledge from the rest of the IT department.
And you can go down a rabbit hole as well. Obviously, we've got a number of commercial tools that we use, and we've also got a number of open source tools, and we'll try and correlate as much as possible. I think that's possibly one of the dangers of a platform like MISP, and I guess having trusted groups, and who's going to be putting feeding information into it to make sure that you can somehow validate it. I think that the whole benefit of having something like that is being able to say, we've seen this before, somebody else has seen it before, actually we've seen it 3 months ago and it was attacking the same sector, but also validating it in terms of, is it that infrastructure known to be bad? Maybe we go and validate who the threat actor is who's created the domain, and we see that actually he's created 50 other domains that look the same. So we try and validate as much as possible, but you can imagine with the amount of stuff we're getting through, it's not always possible. Anybody that says it is not telling the truth.
When you're taking that data from the threat intelligence side and you're starting to refine it to say, oh, this looks like an attack, how hard is it to make sure you're not picking up too many false positives? Because the danger with security is it only takes one false positive for people to mistrust.
For me, it's got to be government and industry driven. It's got to be a collaboration. It doesn't work otherwise. I think building trusted groups, so there's lots of probably different factions of... So Tech UK have got a trusted advisors forum, for example. CP&I have got a cyber defenders workshop. CISP have obviously got the fusions, which we're part of. There are different groups that are trying to do pieces of work in that space, and then at the CISP platform. And I think that was originally intended to be what CircLU have got MISP looking like in terms of global, UK-wide threat sharing. I just think people are still resistant to doing it. There's a couple of reasons. One is around reputation. They don't want to say either they've been breached or this is what they've seen on their network. There's a level of, you know, what's this going to mean? Who's looking at this information that I'm sharing? General concern around threat information sharing in general. It's whether there's benefit that's driven from the active cyber defense initiative that the government are now running as part of the new strategy. And that changes in terms of more collaboration between, I guess, the big SIs like ourselves and IBM and BAE, whether that drives any value from it. Until then, it remains to be seen how successful sticks and as an initiative and sharing criteria.
If we look at some of the higher level attacks we're seeing from the darknet, we have some very clever people coming together, they're collaborating well. If we then look at the defensive position from both vendors and corporate entities, we don't see a lot of collaboration. We see a lot of projects, we see people trying to push stuff into a shared space such as sticks and taxi. What is going to be needed, particularly from threat intelligence, to get everybody to start working together? If we don't share this data, we're not really going to spot many of these attacks.
You can't have the two as disparate entities. I think, you know, at the moment, I don't think in terms of what it means technically, GDPR is fully understood in terms of what we can and can't do. I think there's an element of possibly just building that into company policies in terms of data that they're going to collect and investigate. We have probably the similar issues in terms of HR policies around SSL interception, for example. There's categories that you can ignore. You don't have to intercept or inspect every single piece of encrypted traffic. But whilst you've got that gap and that blind spot in your network, the attackers are winning.
Is there a risk that privacy laws will start to impact our ability to do security intelligence? If we look at the much bigger group of data that's now considered personal and private under GDPR, even things like dynamic IP addresses, we need that data if we're going to start to identify patterns, if we're going to start to identify risk. how do we walk that thin line between having sufficient data and accurate data for security against protecting privacy? Or is there a role for regulators to get themselves together and understand that you can't have the two as wholly disparate entities?
Certainly from sharing on MISP, that's going to be important, and there's obviously elements that you can take out before you share that threat information, certainly in terms of personally identifiable information. When we pull the information together for analytics, the information that we'll publish, say we publish it in a threat intelligence report, will be high-level generic information that we've collected across a number of customers. It'll be information that is either generic in terms of not naming IP addresses or going down to the level of information that would name them, or it'll be public-facing information and stuff that you could find yourself anyway. We're obviously really keen to make sure that we don't do that and we don't release any information that would implicate a customer. I'll give an example of things like publishing or putting something through malware.com, or we wouldn't do that. We've got our own internal sandbox that we'd run it through before it goes anywhere else. We wouldn't, because then you potentially upload an information that you wouldn't want to share.
From a security operations center, of course, this becomes even more of an issue, because you're not just taking data from one company where you're working within their policies. You're taking from multiple customers, and the value to you is being able to aggregate that data. It's not always easy to fully anonymize that data because you lose some of the patterns, particularly for phishing attacks. You can't see the roles if you anonymize it too far. Where do you see the challenge of that for Fujitsu going forwards?
We would help them in terms of information that they need to give us. I guess one of the challenges that we always come across is logging levels that need to be turned on in order to get any value from the logs that we need to see. Processes logging on a domain controller, for example.
Do companies understand what they have to do when they're engaging with a security operations center and they're engaging with a threat intelligence team? Do they understand what they've got to give access to? Do they understand how the type of data that's going to be there? And do they understand what to do when you feed it back to them?
If we provide a threat intelligence report, it will be a technical report in the main, but it will have an exec summary, some recommendations that we advise, this is what you do next. Or actually, if we're providing security operations for them anyway, then we will say, in terms of a policy, maybe we've took on an endpoint protection policy from an incumbent, we suggest you change it to be X, Y, or Z, because it's going to improve your security posture and you're not likely to be hit by malware because you've been left with a lax policy.
We're only 2 months into the year and we've really started to see some interesting attacks coming on. If we look forward, what are your concerns over the next year? What do you think, from a threat intelligence perspective, is going to be the big issues?
It's not going to change. So the same stuff that we saw 6 to 12 months ago, we're still seeing at the beginning of the year. So I think we saw a big shift from banking trojans to business email compromise. We're now seeing ransomware. Don't sort of see ransomware slowing down anytime soon. I think one of the sort of predictions that we said this year is we're potentially going to see a ransomware attack against the smart city. And that's likely to happen in terms of being able to have such an impact that they have no choice but to pay a significant amount of ransom. So that'll be interesting to see whether that happens or not. I know there was an initial attack against the San Francisco sort of tram system. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in that regard. The standard attack that we're seeing in terms of exploit kits and what they're targeting, that hasn't changed. It remains the same. Adobe Flash is still a huge issue. Why do organizations still have Adobe Flash and still run it? Most of external organizations and websites, they're not even using it anymore. So whilst companies and organizations still use it, exploits are still going to be written for it.
Well, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, you're welcome.